Hey, this is Michael Kaz, and on this podcast, I explore ways of living a more wholehearted and fulfilling life. I believe in the saying that what is most personal is most universal. On this podcast, you will hear personal stories of struggle and challenge, and what I and my guests have learned from those experiences. You will hear ideas and concepts that expand your mind on topics like personal development, health, adventure, and sex and relationships. Above all, my intention is to bring a depth of conversation and stories to connect more with my guests and with you. Hey, this is Michael Kaju, and welcome to the show. Today, I'm talking with one of my closest friends, Zach Obrant. Zach is the co-founder of the book publishing company Scribe and the author of the Book in the Box method, as well as the Scribe method. We talk about him almost starting a high school when he was only in college, how he co-founded the company Scribe when he was only 23, which would go on to become one of the best places to work in America. We spend a good bit of time talking about what things they did differently and continue to do to create such an amazing culture. And lastly, we talk about Web3. If you don't know what Web3 is, but you've heard of it, this is another way of saying talking about the crypto world. He goes into depth explaining it and some of the philosophical reasons that he's so excited about it. And with that, please help me welcome Zach Obrant. This episode is brought to you by Drink Element. Element, spelled L-M-N-T, is a healthy alternative to sugary electrolyte drinks. Each grab-and-go stick pack replaces essential electrolytes with no sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, or any other junk. I am particularly stoked about this sponsorship because Element is the only supplement that I take every single day. That's how I get myself to drink more water. When I do my 3-day fast every quarter, or I do a low carb or a keto diet occasionally, then it's a must. You can get really lightheaded and disoriented when you don't have enough electrolytes. My favorite flavors are the citrus and the orange, and there's even a chocolate one that my wife Adi makes with hot water, and it tastes like hot chocolate. It's great. And the proof is in the pudding with Element. It was developed from by Rob Wolf, who, in my opinion, really brought the paleo movement back into the public sphere in the first place. He's a multi-time New York Times bestseller. He's a chemist and so much more. He's a good friend of Adi and mine, as well as his wife. And that's how we were introduced to Element a couple years ago. Dozens of NHL, NFL, and NBA teams are using it, as well as Olympians in many other sports. And as a listener of this show, Element is offering you an Element sample pack. You just cover the cost of shipping, and you can get it by going to drinklmnt.com/Kaz, C-A-Z. That's drinklmnt.com/Kaz. Let's begin the show. Zach, welcome to the show, man.
All right, we're going.
Stoked to have you here, dude.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So we're going to talk about your path a little bit through your career and eventually get to what led you to Web3 and creating what could be a really disruptive technology. But first, I want to start with rock, paper, scissors. You have this belief that you can consistently beat anyone in rock, paper, scissors.
It's a fact.
And the only time we brought this up, we were quite drunk and I was trying to pick your brain on it. But I'm wondering if you can walk us through what goes on in your head that allows you to beat people.
Nothing is in the head. It's all in the body. That has been true my entire life. I don't know why, but I always win rock, paper, scissors. When I first moved to Austin, I was on a volleyball team. And I was kind of joking around about it the first game, because you do rock, paper, scissors for who serves first. And they were like, well, then why don't, yeah, go ahead, do the rock, paper, scissors. And I won it. And then the next week, okay, go again. I won it. By the time we're like 7 weeks in, everyone was like going crazy every week. And I went the entire season, never missed a week.
So one thing that you did, we had like a rock, paper, scissors contest tournament. And I saw you were trying to like fake people out. You would say something like, I'm doing rock on this one. And then you would either actually do it or you wouldn't. And you would use the information, like their behavior, whatever they put as information for something. What are you doing there?
You were studying. No, there's no like strategy. It was, so I used to be really into poker when I was like in high school. So like too young to be actually thoughtful about it, but wanting to get really good. And so at that point, my like dream idol was Daniel Negreanu, who was like, there's the people whose strategy at the table is like, wear the sunglasses, be serious, whatever, which is like, try to give no clues. And his strategy seemed to be the opposite, was like, I'm just going to fuck you up with information. Can I swear on this?
Yes.
That's fine. All right. Yeah. I'm going to fuck you up with information. And I'm going to guess that I can do that in a way that your reaction to it will be worse than 50-50 if I'd given you nothing. And I would do that and completely fail. You know, like I was 16 and 17, but playing at these sketchy home games and having lots of fun. And like, that was my idol. So I never thought about it, but maybe that bled over a little bit into my drunken rock, paper, scissors strategy.
I love it. So I know you're a pretty smart kid in high school or in elementary school, high school. You're great at math. You didn't think it was cool, so you stopped really trying. You eventually started a high school right when you graduated high school. Is that right?
I was in the middle of college. Right? Yeah.
So you're in the middle of college and you start your own high school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was. So I'd for some reason through college, both like not particularly tried, but then also wanted to go really fast. I feel like that's been a pattern in a lot of things where I'm like, especially at that age, I feel like I feel like the ways that I could see myself as impressive were to try to like achieve as much as I could in school or to achieve well while like showing off that I wasn't trying. And I think that's like a very toxic belief. But at that point, that was like, I was all in on that strategy, was like go out the night before exams, like make a point of how little I cared while doing well. And part of that, I think, was like, okay, I'm going to take extra courses every semester and like show that I can juggle all this and all of that. So I was way ahead in my course load. And at the same time, was for some reason it came up where I was talking about online education, which was like kind of a new thing at that point, and thinking a lot about how when I was in high school, I was doing the same thing. I was trying to take extra classes and I took a semester off to work and make some money. So I was trying to get ahead. So I was taking all these classes outside of school. And I was like, I really wish that they'd been online, like that I could do them on my time instead of going to a building, a rundown building 20 minutes away. And so I started to look into like, well, is that allowed and how does that work? And like, what kind of professional would I need to partner with for this to be allowed? Would it have to be someone who's been a principal or could it be just a teacher? And as I looked into the rules, literally the rule was you needed to have a high school diploma. And I was like, that's it? Like, that can't really be true. And so, well, step one of the process is you fill out this form and submit it that you're going to start a school. So I was like, all right, I'll fill out the form. It's like, costs nothing. It takes a few minutes. And then I get back, okay, you've been approved. Step two is you have to send us your whole curriculum. So I went, did this, just kind of kept going one step at a time, not really thinking it was real, until all of a sudden it was like, all right, your next step is once you're launched, we're going to come to your office and do an audit. And I was like, I guess I'm launching. So buckled down and took it really seriously. I like dropped almost all my courses for the semester.
So you go from just like putting one foot in front of the other, feeling like it was almost fake, I don't know, too good to be true or whatever. You get to the end and it's like, okay, you're ready to become an actual school. And what motivated you to drop everything and do this?
I don't think I have good restraint at that point in things. It's like, if something feels possible, I like want to poke and prod around. And then once it works, if I've got the momentum, I tend to just go with it. So I don't think I was super thoughtful except for like, oh, this feels more real and more cool than whatever schoolwork I was going to do that semester. And like, let's give it a shot and see what happens.
And was there any element of this would be a really good learning opportunity, or was there any meaning to it at all?
Yeah. I mean, the meaning, I think not really as a learning opportunity. The meaning was like, I really did and still do like believe that education needs to be fundamentally rethought. Mm-hmm. And so one of the pillars that was really strong at that point that I still believe, but maybe is like less high on the priority stack, is that like, everyone moving along at the same pace and being guided by like the constraints of being in a room together just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, that was really clear to me and had felt really frustrating to me at other points. And so felt really excited about like, wow, I can do this. And like, it'll be cool for kids to sign up for this and work on their own schedule and teach them how to work independently and all of that. But yeah, I was at the time, I didn't think of myself as that young. But looking back, I was so young and naive, and the way I approached all of it was very like, almost like, oh my God, I've got this secret that I'm doing this, and like, when's someone going to catch me cheating? As opposed to just like, this is something that matters, and why wouldn't I do it? Mm-hmm.
And so what ended up happening?
So I got all the kind of the curriculums built, sent it to them, got approved. And the last phase was they come into your office and which would be like my little room. It had to have a filing cabinet with a lock. That was the only criteria for the office.
And did you go out to Office Depot or whatever you'll have in Canada? And
of course, I had to get my to put your student records in. And so I got to the last page, and then my next step was I got to get students to come. And two things happened. So first, I struggled to get students. I got, I think, one or two signed up really fast. You needed to have over, I think it was 5 or 10. And this is where I go back to like not understanding business, not wanting to have mentors or anything. I was like, oh, I just like threw up a website and it was like sign up and pay. And like now it's so obvious that like a decision of what school to go to, there needed to be some kind of like talk to someone or get more information or whatever. I was so new to all of this and it taught me a lot, but I was just like, I sponsored a baseball tournament. I went out and handed out flyers. No way. I stuck flyers on the wall of schools where there might be like potential students. And so I drummed up a little interest, but I was struggling. And that was kind of through the summer. And I needed this by September. And then in the summer, I found out that I could also offer AP credits. And I'm like, if I can offer AP credits, now all my friends can get college credits. Like, can people who are already done with high school do it? Or if not, it's just an edge that maybe people will want, whatever. And so I went to go through the application of applying for AP credits. And through that, they basically seemed to get frustrated and like see that I was young and see that I was alone and kind of raise some flags. And so I don't know. I question where the decision came from. That like in my mind at that point was like, oh, they're giving me trouble. I don't want to go through the legal battles. I'm out. The reality was, I think I was a little bit defeated from struggling to find students and a little bit like quick and easy to be intimidated. And just the mix of all of it, I was like, well, I can just bail on all this and go back to going to school in September and not have this. And ended up just saying like, all right, I'm going to wrap it up. I think there's a good justification with the like legal and complexity stuff. But looking back, I think I probably could have pushed it a little further. I was very scared of being like, the last thing I want is that someone enrolls in this and then it gets shut down and I screw up these kids' high school education and they're behind and whatever. So I was like probably wisely a little bit overprotective and ended up just bailing on it and never touching it again. Mm-hmm. Which for years, even once I was like much more successful and it didn't really matter, I still own the domain name and it would kind of plague me of like, I'm going to do something with that one day. I got those curriculums done. I want to do it. But at some point I just had to let it go.
Yeah, I'm waiting to enroll Shai in your school sure.
By that point, I'll have it. It'll be
amazing.
Great.
I love the audacity just to throw yourself into something so kind of big and scary. It seems big and scary.
Yeah.
And it's such a big responsibility, kids' education.
Right. Yeah, it seemed maybe I think I'd been so unimpressed with so many parts of my high school education that I'm like, okay, so like the way the school was set up, it was just going to be English and data management, two 12th grade classes, nothing else that you could take outside of school. And I was like, I thought back to like my grade 12 English teacher, my grade 12 data management teacher. I'm like, I could teach this way better than them. So it kind of like, it centered me on like, what's the bar that I can meet to make this better for people instead of trying to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. It's not like they're many schools. It's not like many have like a think tank where they're all collaborating on how to make it entertaining for kids. It's like grab a textbook and then just teach what's in the textbook.
Exactly. I don't know if there was Amazon at that point, but like I could track down the same textbooks and that's where I was building it all from. And I'm like, all right, I'm doing this versus the teacher I had. I can see objectively that, all right, this would be a better class and I would have preferred to take it. But yeah, I think like mindset wise and experience wise, there were just like too many other things that got in my way of doing it the way I probably should have. Mm-hmm.
So to fast forward a little bit, years later, you would start Scribe, which has become a really disruptive company in the book publishing space. I'm trying to build a little bit of an infrastructure for what prepared you to start that company. Were there any other major milestones on the way that really helped you succeed in Scribe?
Truthfully, I mean, I could list a whole bunch of things that I'd done. Basically spent the years between college and Scribe doing exactly what I just described, like frantically starting everything that sounded fun, getting it to the point where it was working, and then either getting bored and bailing, trying to sell it to a partner, just like no barrier to starting something and therefore dealing with all the consequences of that later. So I like, God, I got to think back, but I started a like a small like telecom company. I started a mold removal company that was like, I was out doing mold inspections in people's houses.
Oh, shit.
Wearing my company polo and with my flashlight in the attic. I was working on a nonprofit that had this cool model and was building schools in Mongolia. Like I was all over the place. and not because I cared about those things at all. It was very much the like, there's a cool thing to do. I think I just, through a lot of education, had felt kind of like there wasn't a place to pour excitement and interest. And all of a sudden it existed and I was just all over the place. So by the time I'd done a few years of that, a few things had worked out and like having a partner buy me out or whatever, where I like had enough cash to kind of not be in a huge rush. And I was like, all right, I got to take a step for a second and think about like, what am I going to do that's going to keep me interested for more than 10 minutes? And through that point, I had been talking to Tucker a bunch about what he was working on. And he was doing something separate, but it was involving books. And
how did y'all meet?
I think I just emailed him at some point. First, I can't remember if this is true, but I have this memory that he looked at my LinkedIn profile once. And I was like, what? Tucker Max? Why is he looking at it? And I emailed him. We chatted a little bit. And I talked to Ryan, who he was working with at the time as well. Mm-hmm. And so between the two of them, I was like, all right, like, let's what are you guys doing? Like, I'll see if there's anywhere that I can help out. And so
I want to stop here. I think I've always thought this was significant. Tucker is a multi-time national bestseller. He's sold millions of books and he's also 10 years older than you. So there's something I think really impressive in the fact that he saw something so sharp and powerful in you to offer you to work with him.
Yeah, he has a good track record with that. I mean, we were just talking about your interview with Charlie Hone. Mm-hmm. They had a relationship of working together with Ryan similarly. And I think with all of those people, he saw that maybe sooner than it was probably obvious to people at some point, but he saw it early. Mm-hmm. And really like leaned into it and was incredibly, I think, like generous and helpful and wise in a lot of how he supported all of our growths. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for me at that point, it was a lot more informal. You know, I was doing some other things and it was like, oh, cool. He's working on some interesting stuff. Maybe there's something I can do on the side and kind of help them a few hours a week. And slowly that few hours a week turned into, well, do you want a full-time job? And okay, well, as long as it's remote and can work around the other things I'm doing, we can make that work. And then basically what they were working on started to dissolve. And Tucker and I just decided, hey, like the two of us are having the most fun working together. We both are most interested in the book space. Let's just like keep this going and see what happens. And so we basically spent probably 6 months after that where Tucker had a lot of inflow of people asking him questions about books. And I was like, I'm just going to learn everything that exists in this space and whatever problem someone has, I'm going to try to solve it for them. So it was like ranging from like helping people with certain bookstores they wanted to get into, helping to source designers, doing book marketing, like the gamut of any problem that could come up. And through all that, I mean, this kind of leads into the scribe stuff, but through all that, the frustration that we were feeling was that when you do a slice of a book, you're very often fixing someone else's mistake. You know, it's like, or just your hands are tied by the work someone else did. So if we were going to do marketing, but the book wasn't good, or we were going to try to market it, but the concept, it would have been better off if we could have had some input on the concept of how it'd be more marketable. Mm-hmm. All of it felt like the connections between the things were the problems. And so through all that time, we were like, well, it'd be great if we could find someone to just help start to finish.
And usually in the traditional publishing model, there are contractors working on different pieces that aren't working under the same umbrella. Is that right?
So they're usually all together.
Okay.
But then a lot of authors will hire outside of that. So they're like, okay, they're going to a publisher, which is their designer and editor, but they're kind of on their own in terms of figuring out the positioning of the book. Maybe their agent helps a little bit who's outside, and then maybe they hire a marketing firm outside. So things weren't always under one roof. And a lot of the people we were working with were either self-publishing or kind of doing some part of it on their own, and were the bridge between the areas were where a lot of the challenges came up. And there wasn't someone at the beginning to say, here are all the things that should go into the decisions you're making early. People were halfway down the road by the time they met us or someone else that could be more helpful. And so in the middle of all that, Tucker meets this woman at some entrepreneur dinner, and she's in that exact position. She's like, I want to do a book. Don't know where to start, whatever. And so he puts me on the phone with her and I'm like, you're the person we're looking for. Like, let's work together. We'll get you all the way through start to finish. And so we help position the book, figure out the direction, interviewed her to do like the ghostwriting and worked with her on the editing for it, found the designer, the layout, publishing, marketing, all the way through start to finish. And at the end of it was like, not only did that work better, she paid more, it was easier because we weren't having to like do project management across different people. All of that put aside, the book is on my shelf and I'm way more excited being like, we helped make that book versus just doing a job. Mm-hmm. And so once we saw that, Tucker was immediately like, we drop everything, we have to do this. And I was, what was I? I was 23. And I was like, no, this is great, but we can still do everything else too. People are offering us money. We got to take all of it.
Yeah. What about Mongolia?
Right. Yeah. And like, yeah, the other things, but even at that point I was pretty centered on books, but it was like someone's offering money to do something. And I'm like, oh, but we could learn from that. It's a good portfolio, whatever. I was in the like a little bit of scarcity, like say yes to everything space. And he, to his credit, he was like, cool, you want to do it? Then it's like, it's on you. And so I spent 2 or 3 months trying to juggle that, had a complete meltdown. Like I was living in Chile because I was waiting for my US visa, and just like 4 things blew up at the same time. This, actually, I can't get into details about some of it, but things were very frustrating and bad with a lot of these interactions. And I was just way overwhelmed. I like couldn't go into the mode of like save the day because there was only one of me. And through all that, I was like, all right, you were right. Let's say no to everything. Let's just do this like start to finish book process and let's see where it goes. And immediately it took off so much more than everything else. So within a few months after that, we hired the first few people, but we're still kind of seeing it as like, oh, this is our thing. And we found some people to help. And then as it grew, it was like, all right, more people are joining and more people are joining. And at some point it was like, oh, this is a real company. I was still relatively unprepared in terms of the business side, but I had a good sense of like how to start things and understand what customers needed. I had diehard, like make every customer happy no matter what gets in the way. And I knew publishing well at that point just by having worked on all those one-off projects. Mm-hmm. And so those things were like enough of the raw materials to make it work and make sure that the people working with us were happy and the business was moving. But it made things a little rocky as we grew because I wasn't a leader and I wasn't thoughtful about what growth really looks like.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Most people, in my experience, focus way more on external marketing, like just trying to get new people in the door at the expense a lot of times in customer service or quality. What do you think it was about you or your experience that had you focus so much on that, on the actual product?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So one piece was that we were really lucky. Like Tucker having an audience and being able to get in the door at some of these bigger podcasts was like a lot of our media and attention early on, and having some articles that took off. I think like we had an advantage that most brand new companies wouldn't have. And the product was really meeting a need where there was just a crazy amount of word of mouth right off the bat. So like maybe if our sales were stagnant and the revenue wasn't good, I might've had to fall back to that. But because we were in a place of not, that wasn't the barrier. Mm-hmm. It didn't kind of force that. And then the other thing is the cool thing with authors, especially for me as like a 23-year-old kid, I'm like, I get to meet all these people. It's nonfiction authors. They're all an expert at something. They can all afford a service like this. They were all really cool people. And at the beginning, I was doing a lot of the like help people position the books and really kind of in the weeds with them. And I was learning so much. And so very quickly with almost every author, I had a relationship where I was like, okay, they just did a sales call with a 23-year-old kid and signed a very expensive package. And now I'm working with them and getting to know them. I'm not going to let them down. Like, I'm not going to let that be a bad decision. And so when it came down to it, when there were hard trade-offs between making clients happy and other areas of the business, I always chose making clients happy. And when it was between making clients happy and like my personal life, I always chose making clients happy. Like there's good and bad of that. But I think in a company like this as an early stage, it meant that 25 out of 30 of our first people were through the moon, happy, strong relationship talking about us. And that was a lot of the kind of ground for us to be able to grow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So Scribe has gone on to become the absolute best place to work in the country for its size. How many employees do y'all have now?
We're 95, I think.
95.
Yeah.
And how many years have y'all gotten that?
There's a few different things if we want to be precise. We got number one culture in America from Entrepreneur Magazine. Mm-hmm. That was just a one-time thing they did. And then the like Texas does like best place to work in Texas. or best places to work in Austin, whenever we jump around every year, we've been kind of between number one and number five the past 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious what makes Scribe such a great place to work, and specifically things that might surprise people.
Yeah.
And it's okay if y'all just simply do the basic things extraordinarily well, that's fine too.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's really basic things, unfortunately. Because I think most basic things are still like within a paradigm that's not great for like autonomy and energy and fun for the team. So I'll tell you where it comes from and then what our path was. Where it came from was like I said, the good and bad of when Tucker and I are just the two of us and we add two people and we're like both pretty inexperienced at like how a company grows and used to just working the two of us and still kind of having the mindset of like, oh, cool, we're working on things. And like, now we have two people to help. The bad of that is like, it's not good for scale. The good of that is that our immediate instinct was like, why would they be treated any different than we are? And why would they not just be treated like, oh, yeah, we're not going to like
as buy owners, ourselves. Like why would them as employees be treated differently as owners?
Okay. And not like treated differently, like, oh, we get ourselves first class flights and we get them shitty flights. I think that would, a lot of places might do that. More like, why is the way we're approaching work different? You know, like we're both more entrepreneurial. We're both really happy if like there's an important relationship we want to build and the person's in town and we're going to go take the person for lunch and take a big chunk of the day to get to know them. Why would the rest of the team not do that? And there just kept being things that came up where the way that we were working both on our own and then interacting with each other was different than the way the rest of the team as they were joining were working. And a lot of those things were areas where they would want to work more like us, but they just thought it wasn't allowed. One guy was coming from an accounting firm. They had expectations of what work should look like that were somewhat kind of like restrictive and following orders, even when they were trying to not be like that. Just like even when they knew that that's not what to do, not what we wanted them to do, that was just their frame for what work should be. And so we started being intentional about culture, not because we're like, oh, we want to have a good culture or we want to write something up, but because we were examining what are the ways that we're working with each other that are working and how do we want to like express that to new people as they join and how do we want to reinforce that so that they understand what they're allowed to do that they're not letting themselves do. So the culture from the very start was very focused around like what it means to have more autonomy and freedom and flexibility in work that's based around results as opposed to like work theater. And also
work theater, what do you mean by that?
Like trying to show off how much you're doing. And then also both Tucker and I really saw work as like an avenue for personal growth. And we're really big on like feedback for each other and taking time to like understand what was getting in our way and not trying to separate like work life from personal life. And so we were really intent from the beginning on like the best way to work well is to grow personally. And the best way to grow personally is like to get feedback as you're doing things, and work is a good avenue to get that feedback. And like, we can be one part of that cycle in someone's life.
I love that. Yeah. Like if getting the most feedback possible as quickly as possible is the best for growth, which I think it is, doing that in a business setting makes so much sense.
Right.
And because there are results, there are meetings.
And what I see in a lot of companies is that the types of feedback they're comfortable, even if they're really big on feedback, the types of feedback they're comfortable with is a narrow range. And what we've found is like, there aren't really business problems. There's personal problems that come up in a work context. And that basically any business problem is solvable.
That's gold.
You know, it's like, if it's not solvable by you, it's solvable by going to hire someone. Like there's no way that anything you're facing is just like impossible to figure out. So what's getting in the way of doing it? And so we were really intent early on going that extra step deeper of like, okay, if someone's struggling, great. Let's get into it and actually try to help them grow in the way they need to solve it, not the work version of like put a Band-Aid on it and memorize rules. So we did a lot early on around strengths and obstacles, which we can talk about that we did at WAG as well. Mm-hmm. And some other practices that were really saying like, we're going to make the space to try to give each other the feedback to grow as people and to expect that all of us show up to work as our kind of full selves, as opposed to just this like work self. And so
sort of dissolving work and personal life.
Yeah. Like seeing that as a balance, that those two things trade off is like, no, they should both thrive, but like how do they should be supporting each other. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't start with like too much of a plan, except for that when things came up that contradicted that we did or that anyone else did, we would try to talk about it as a team and be like, well, how should we have handled that? And is there something we could formulate so that future people joining might be able to learn that lesson without going through it? And so out of that came Strengths and Obstacles. Out of that came our culture doc, which became the culture Bible and has kind of like become the bedrock of what I think attracts really great people to want to work at Scribe and like keeps them engaged and excited as they work there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that comes up when you're saying that is I think typically most people write hiring letters or outreach letters to look for new people in a very like rote, boring way. This is the job description. You are right for this if you are blank, 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 blank. And it just feels like when I go to your site, when I go to the careers page, it just feels so fun and so authentic to who you guys are. So naturally, the people that are most aligned with you are going to be attracted to that rather than most people are just, they're all writing in the same exact way or communicating in the same exact way when they're looking for people.
Yeah. The other part of that is that there's a challenge, which is expressing that filters for the type of people who are interested in it, but it also filters for people who aspirationally want that and are kind of looking for an outside way, especially a lot of the talk around like responsibility and freedom and flexibility and autonomy. There are a lot of people who maybe aren't living that in their lives, but are looking for someone to like say that that's, you know, they're looking for it externally. Mm-hmm. And so it's a challenge in hiring where we get a huge number of applicants for things. And the biggest challenge we found is like, okay, the skill stuff is pretty easy to filter on. How do we get really good at assessing from a culture perspective who's going to fit and add to the culture versus who is looking to kind of like attach themselves to the culture to make themselves feel good without actually really embodying
and just kind of learn and take rather than contribute.
And learning and taking is good because everyone's doing a job. It's more like check the box that I'm this kind of person because I work at a company that's like this, but then not actually really do the hard work of living it.
Mm-hmm. Has anything big come up on how to filter for that piece?
Lots of perspectives. Like the biggest shift, we resisted for so long the number of interviews that is needed to really discern that. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, how many people do we need to talk to? But the reality is like, so now when someone applies, there's like one round that's more like a quick assessment, one round that's with the person who's the direct support that's more like role-based, then maybe another conversation, and then an onsite where they talk to 4 to 5 people back to back in a day. And it's like, it can feel a little like a lot, but I think like the people who are really excited are energized by that as opposed to drained. And very often there's something that the fourth person who talks to them sees that's kind of a red flag that matches a pattern of something we've seen before. It's having all those perspectives and just the experience of now kind of like seeing how things play out. The number of times early on where people would disagree, but I'm like, no, I know this is going to work. Like I know. And then I was wrong almost always. And so I think we've all gotten better at seeing those patterns and then having kind of the joint hive mind has helped a lot where like, we'll talk about the new company, but when I'm starting this new company, the number one thing that I'm worried about is like, I can't rebuild a hiring process that good. And to the point where I've gone to Scribe now and been like, can I pay Scribe to help me with hiring? Because that process is the best thing that the whole company does.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's huge. Yeah. So often we hear that the people are the biggest investment, biggest opportunity, also the biggest risk if you get it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally true. Especially because like, it's bad for a business, but it's also just shitty. Like once you've had to fire someone who you really care about, you don't want to screw up anymore. You know, it's like that just sucks.
Yeah. So let's talk about Strengths and Obstacles, right, at least briefly. So what is it?
So it's something we started right at the beginning. So we did the first Strengths and Obstacles like a few months after the first people joined. Wow. And
where did this idea come from?
Yeah. So this is interesting. So one of the early people was living in the UK and he came over to Austin for the first 3 months of work for us to kind of work more closely together and then was going to go back and work remote. And at the end of those 3 months, I don't know if it was him asking for feedback or what the situation was, but there were a number of things where he was basically like, I know I need to level up in some ways to be able to really hold it down remotely. Like, let's talk about that. And Tucker and I had already kind of had this, not as formal of a process, but had made a point of being consistent with, I don't know, it's nice to always say like, oh, we give all the good feedback in the moment. But sometimes there's these kind of more abstract patterns where there's never really a moment that brings it up, but it's something that deserves a voice. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of had a habit of finding time somewhat regularly to be having those kinds of conversations. And so the combination of him asking and all that, we're like, well, let's just do that like as a group with all four of us at that point. And so we decided to take some time, I think it was like a full day for the four of us, and just to spend 2 hours on each person and really go through like, what are the areas that of growth for them? And what we ended up finding was like, there's no such thing as just areas of growth, right? Like, I could tell you, you should really practice basketball, but like, it depends if you want to be better at basketball. And
just if you need to be better at basketball, like what about basketball?
Right. And like, but that even the starting premise of like, what the only purpose of growth is to meet a goal that you have. Mm-hmm. Right. And so so through iterations and other kind of thinking about it and Tucker bringing some to it, where we landed with that one, which is the pattern that stuck for a very long time, is that we would spend the beginning time purely on positives. What are things you've noticed about the person that impressed you, especially things that they might not see about themselves? Then great, let's pause on that.
So just for a little bit of context for those listening. So you're sitting in a room, every person has 2 hours in the hot seat. Mm-hmm. So for the first section, say 30 minutes, the other three are giving all of the affirmations and praises, both personally and professionally, about the person in the hot seat.
Yeah. And it very often was fitting that pattern of like, it wasn't like, I like the way that you did this. You sent emails, you know, it's like, it's the things that don't come up day to day that are more about like how you see them as a person that I think was really impactful for people. So once that's done, then we can't talk about obstacles until we know what they could be obstacles to. So there's a period then of really focusing on what
can we stop here wants. for just a second. I think this is such a key distinction that you're glossing over a little bit. Like, a lot of companies, the way that they're run is from the top down. The top sets the goals or helps the person they're mentoring or that's under them set the goals that align with the goals of the business, but the person might not actually care at all. So they're very unlikely to succeed long term and or enjoy what they're doing. Right. And so y'all are completely flipping that and just saying, what are your goals and related to the business as well as personally, and let's help you reach those goals.
Yeah. It's the unstated assumption in all feedback is, and I think you want to improve in this, mm-hmm. right? That like, especially in a work context, is like, you should do this differently because you want to be like me and you want to know everything I know, not necessarily because it's a goal you have. Mm-hmm. Like those conversations were often a place that people got more clarity than they had before. You know, in some cases it was like, this is really what I want. I know that. But there were times, especially as we grew, 40 people sitting in a circle, and on the spot, we'd realize that someone wants to switch to a new job and decide, all right, you're switching to this role. Wow. Everyone kind of gets shivers and is like, oh my God, this is like, it's right. So a period of kind of getting clarity there, which sometimes could last almost the whole rest of the 2 hours of really digging in there. Sometimes is like, all right, we've got it. That feels sharp. And then it flips back to everyone else's feedback, specifically on what are the things you're noticing or would see in that person that would stop them from getting those goals, or stop them from being that person that they want to be.
And this is where kind of the work starts.
Yeah. And that it was amazing to see how powerful that could be while being disorganized and crowdsourced. You know, you think like, maybe that could be good in like a regimented way, or maybe that could be good with a therapist who's just a one-on-one and can kind of navigate the conversation. And certainly there was always a leader of it where Tucker would lead it or I would to help kind of keep it on track and direct it a little bit. But the wisdom of the group around what was getting in people's way was so profoundly positive that like, we did that first one and we were like, what the hell did we just stumble on? Like, wow. This felt like kind of a simple made up structure, and it was incredible. And so 3 months later, at our next kind of quarterly thing, we did, there were probably 6 or 7 people. We did another one. It was pretty good. And then the next one, we were probably 10, 11, 12 people. And it was mind-boggling. We took 2 full days to do it, and multiple of them were like life-changing for the person. And slowly, at the beginning, I think it was a little more work-focused. Then it got, by that point, it was like, okay, it's clear. This is like the deep work that people need to do, or at least to start them on the journey of what they need to do to be the person they want to be. Mm-hmm. And so from there, it just kind of continued to grow and change, with the challenge being one of the big benefits of this was being able to get the entire company together. It created incredible bonds between people, and like the dinners the night after that were just always amazing. But you can't have 40 people all take 2 hours.
Or 96,
Or 96 people all take 2 hours. So we experimented with a few things, with splitting into smaller groups to do it, or with having everyone gather up, but just a few people go. We experimented with something that Philip did, of bringing one last talk in and doing that. But honestly, at this point now, we've paused doing it. We've got some other things we're working on in what we call the whole self program. That's more small groups reading more regularly in other ways. But I think it was like an amazing thing to do. And I actually think it's still like the way you all did it for just the executive team. I think it would.
So Zach came in and facilitated for 8 of us at WAG.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is a model that can work. Mm-hmm. The whole company thing, it's one of the saddest things for me as the company grew. It was like, that was one of, I feel like you can't say your culture will never change. Like if it's never going to change, it's going to be stagnant. What a 10 person company needs, 30, 50, 100 is so different that like for us, our culture is totally adaptable to what the organization is, to the point that we just rewrote the entire culture Bible. Wow. Because it was written for a startup, and we're more of a mature company now. And so a lot of those things, I was comfortable with the changes. That was one of the hardest ones that I just held on to, because like the emotion and memory around how good it was and knowing that we weren't going to be able to continue to recreate that. Mm-hmm. We struggled with it for a long time, but I think we're at peace with it now. There'll be other versions and other things. But I miss that a lot.
Well, you know this, when you facilitated for us, and we did it the next year as well, it had some profound impacts on our team. It cleared up year-long rifts between some people. What it did for some people personally is it gave them clarity on things that were holding them back. It gave them permission to think much bigger. It allowed them more autonomy, more freedom to think big, to think bigger. It was so huge for us, man.
Yeah.
It just brought us closer together.
I love doing it. I didn't know what it would be like, because so much of doing it at Scribe is like, well, if you're directing it, you kind of know the person, you kind of know where it'll go. And so coming to WAG, where I'm like, I've never seen this person's face before, I don't know anything about them, hopefully I can support in some way for the group to help guide them. And in some ways it was even more powerful, because it was everyone kind of working as a team to support each other without as much guidance. It was cool to see that, like, it's hard to be mad at someone when you see exactly what they're struggling with, and see that the thing that you're kind of hating them for is a thing that they're like trying really hard to work on, and there's something getting in their way. It's such a different perspective than like, this person always writes short emails and it makes me sad and I think they hate me. You know, it changes the relationship a lot.
Yeah. So there are three steps. There's the positive affirmations, there's the setting of personal, professional, and relationship goals. That's step 2. And then the third step is, what are your obstacles? What's getting in the way of you reaching all of the goals you just set out? And I'm curious, do you have any like anonymous examples of how the obstacle can go, just to give people a little bit of context on like how deep it can go?
Sure. I won't share any of the really deep ones, because that's maybe a little too intense. But the one that comes to mind actually was the third time, which felt to me like the first time that I was like, oh, this got real and like shifted the way someone sees themselves. There was a guy on the team who, I'll try to not give any too specific details, but he was from a small town, and his previous job had been like the right-hand man of the big shot in town. And so the big shot wasn't that big of a shot, and his role was kind of like half assistant, half whatever. But like, he had kind of built up this image of like, oh, I'm the man. And then he took this role at Scribe, which was like, credit to him, he like took a step back from being in charge to a more junior role and really wanted to learn. but was really not taking feedback or like absorbing or learning, and had a number of things that were getting in his way. And basically where that he was clear in his goals of like, he wanted big professional growth into leadership long-term and like had the patience to get there and all of that. And as we got to the obstacles, what became really clear was that he was kind of like the high school athlete who goes to college, who was like, they're used to being like the player on the team and need to realize like, you're swimming with bigger fish now, and like you can get there, but you can't think you're already there. And it was a long conversation and a lot of shifting for him to basically go from being like, I need to protect the image that I already know everything, to I'm in learner mode, and I'm here to like absorb and slowly get to the point of being able to have that once I actually feel like I know enough to be there, as opposed to trying to like maintain the facade now. Mm-hmm. And so that like, it jumps to mind because it was the first time where I was just like, that's something that he had never seen and totally shifted things going forward. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's something to be said for the like context in which that feedback was given. Totally. I saw how you facilitated. I know Tucker personally. I know that the way that you speak is so compassionate, and it just feels like it's coming from a place of love and not judgment. Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's coming, like you're not expressing that from a place of anger. You're doing it purely to help him.
Yeah. I think, and I've had conversations with the people about this who are trying to facilitate it. And it's like, it's only because it's actually true. You know, like you can't really fake that. Yeah. And I think the setup supports that well, where like they're reminded of all the things that you see positive in them. So it's not like this pure negative. I think a lot of like personal development stuff can focus on the negative because that's where there's work to do, mm-hmm. but then it can kind of pollute the mind space to think like everything's negative.
Yeah.
And so like the space to feel like, okay, all these people do see positive in me. And then all the feedback they're giving me is based on what I just told them I want. And they're trying to help me get there, not things they see about me that they wish were different. And like neither of those are tactics as much as like, no, that's actually the frame that the obstacles like should be given and received in, is like based on what the person needs and trying to actually care and support mm-hmm. them. So, we definitely weren't like brilliant and strategic with it. We kind of just stumbled on something that we were like, there's magic here and mm-hmm. we're going to keep enjoying it while it lasts.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
So you're doing this for several years. Y'all blow up. You're a household name in the like thought leader space, the people who want to write books space. And then last year you make a complete pivot. You start learning about some deep science, biology, computer programming. And I don't want to go through that whole journey, but I'm so curious what makes you different in this way. So most people, when they have the level of success that you've had at Scribe, have golden handcuffs where even if they feel like their passion for the project has gone a little bit and they're interested in other things, they can't even begin to think about leaving and trying something new, because what if it's not as successful as the thing before, right? What do you think gave you the courage or the ability to go out and try this?
Yeah, I'm definitely not immune to that. I mean, I've battled a lot this year with the feeling of needing to do something big, as opposed to just like letting myself purely explore. But I actually what made it easier goes back a little bit, which is like my role at Scribe. So after a couple years of running Scribe, we decided like, all right, this company's growing. There's 15, 20 people. It needs someone who's going to really like lead it. And we were doing that, but we both kind of saw leader like management as like the thing that's distracting us from the work we want to do. Both because we weren't that good at it, and because like when I look at my calendar, when it's filled with meetings, I'm like, oh, I don't have time to work. Not I'm working. And a big part of it was just like, if we were going to give it our all, we still would be A-minus managers, and like the company deserved better than that. So we got so lucky, I won't get into it all, but we found Javon, who's like now the CEO of Scribe. We hired him as the CEO at that point. He's now the majority stakeholder, is like the most incredible person. And so that at that point freed me up to say, okay, what's my role here that actually does make sense for me? And basically from that point through last year, it was if something is dramatically broken to the point of being needing to be rebuilt, or if something we want to start something new, throw Zach at it, let me treat it like a little startup, get it to be 8-10 people kind of functioning well, and then pass it back to the mothership to clean up the mess a little bit. And so we did that with our publishing department. We did that with, we used to offer no book marketing. We started the author marketing department, did that with doing bulk sales, just a number of these projects, which was, we want to do something new, start it, kind of get that beginning entrepreneur energy, which actually was the biggest growth for me more than anything else in the company, because my instinct was to, I'm very good at those kinds of things, but I'm very good at them up to like two people and chaos. And it taught me to be like, okay, well, if I enjoy this, I need to be good at leading it up till when it's 8 or 10 people and really be a good leader at that point, not be making a mess of things. And so it was a lot of my growth was saying like, how do I become an A, I don't need to be an A plus CEO of a 100 person company, but how do I be an A plus leader of a 10 person team? So I did that for those years. And basically at the end of last year, we'd hired the woman who was taking over the author marketing team, which was like a bigger team. I was leading of 14, 15 people. And we were transitioning to her and kind of thinking what's next. And we had our roadmap of things we wanted to build. And I was like reluctant to bring it up. And I was like, hey guys, like all of these things feel like we're following the path. And I kind of know what that process is going to be like. And at this point, like starting something new isn't this like out there entrepreneurial creative thing. We've got the formula. And like the ops team at Scribe might be as good at that as I am, and certainly would be more energized by it because I'm like feeling like it's repetitive. Mm-hmm. And what I'm feeling really excited by was a lot of the code, AI, bio stuff. Like I was just on nights and weekends spending a ton of time doing that and have always kind of coded on the side, but never let myself think of it as serious and like a career thing. So I just build stuff for Scribe and just because I wanted to and use that as an excuse. And so like, I think a big part of this honestly was being helped by having amazing business partners because they were like, cool, you want to do that? Why don't you take a year to learn and then we'll revisit it? And honestly, at the beginning, I felt so guilty. I think we chatted about it at that point where I'm like, wait, but I'm not working. Like I woke up and I'm taking a course. Like who's going to catch me? Like, should I check Slack 30 times a day? Maybe someone needs me, just like not knowing how to, that was allowed. Mm-hmm. But pretty quickly got in the rhythm of just saying, okay, my job is to explore and see where I'm going to end up going deeper. And so, yeah, spent some time on AI, some time on AI focused on bio, some focused on language, I built a lot of stuff for Scribe that was kind of bigger projects that were more needed. But in the end of all that was like, all right, I'll try out this Web3 thing. I'll experiment with it. It was like the last thing on my list of areas that I wanted to explore before going deeper down.
And we'll get in and define that in a second for those of you who aren't familiar.
And literally like 2 days in, I was like, damn it, this is it. Like I'm never touching AI again. It's so clear. I don't know. We could talk a little bit about why, but basically it was just the whole year I was journaling and thinking and trying to evaluate what I liked best and didn't like and what would have potential. And as soon as I touched this space, the weirdest thing happened where it just melted away, where I was like 2 weeks in being like, okay, I've committed my whole life to this. I actually haven't stopped and thought about it at all yet. It's just like the wave is pulling me and it feels good. And like, I'm trusting that. And so, yeah, since then, it's just been 100% in that world and enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a great segue. One thing that I think I know about you is that while you always have your eyes on doing big things, you are insistent on them being meaningful to you and making an actual significant impact on people's lives. So what is Web3 for people? And why do you feel like it's meaningful?
Yeah. So Web3 is basically the rebranded term for crypto blockchain stuff. I think a lot of that was, I shouldn't say polluted, but somewhat polluted by both a extreme focus on decentralization, which I think is like a crucial piece of the puzzle to build other cool things on top of, not the end in and of itself, and by being currency investing focused. And so Web3 is kind of the new wave of people saying, hey, now that we've got this technology, there's actually things that are really cool that we can build that are important and interesting for society that leverage this technology. And like, we don't want to be associated with the like pure degenerate investing or pure like focus on decentralization. It's kind of this new wave of what the internet can be and how it can connect and bring people together.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, just say a little bit more about why this was so attractive to you when you were working on other things that are cutting edge technologies.
Yeah. The answer honestly is that there isn't a why. Like the whole year I was like, well, AI, like bio is like the most important problem is whatever. Like it was very thinking driven. And this was just like, it feels right. And there's a lot of that is biased by like, it's fun and the space is really energizing. And they're like, people are thinking about big ideas and being creative and moving fast. And there's a lot that's just like invigorating about it. But here's the way I would think of it in terms of like the why I think it's a really interesting space to play is if you look back to like people always quote Paul Krugman talking about the internet, that in 1995 he said the impact of the internet will be no greater than a fax machine, and people look at that as a way to like laugh at him and or call him stupid or whatever. But if you really zoom in at that point, what is the internet before it has all the apps or anything else? What is it? It's a way to exchange information, and fax machines do that perfectly fine. And so it wouldn't be out of the question for him to say, well, all it's doing is a fax machine. Yes, it's faster. Yes, it's programmable. Yes, it's like permissionless, but like who cares about those things? We already know how to exchange information. What's the big deal? And what we've seen over the last 25 years is that when you have that foundation and you can add email on top of it, and then email unlocks other things. And then once it's programmable, then apps can move to the front end. And there's all of these advances that even in the first 5 years of the internet, people weren't really coming up with, you know?
So you could build technologies that weren't even fathomable at the time.
And that if you were trying to defend that against Paul Krugman in 1995, you probably couldn't think of all the use. You wouldn't be like, oh, well, there's going to be this thing, Instagram. It's like, well, no, now you have to assume that there's phones and cameras on the phones. Like, they're good and bad. It's just hard to predict where things go. And so if you were trying to defend it at that point, it's more of this almost feeling of like, no, free exchange of information matters and will be a building block that we can build everything on top of. And that like websites are the foundational piece of that, that you can use websites to exchange information and we can do all kinds of cool stuff. And so I see this movement as very, very similar, where people are really quick to be like, well, what can it do? I could do this without blockchain, whatever. And in a lot of cases, they're right. But what I see at its core is the way that the internet was about information flowing that way. Web3 is all about ownership flowing that way. It's the ability to share ownership in something in a way that is free and is permissionless and is programmable. Fundamentally is a building block that all these other things can build on top of. And it's really easy to say, the same as a fax machine. Well, you could do that with an LLC. But I mean, an example that just happened where 17,000 people teamed up to chip in money to try to buy the Constitution. And it didn't end up going through. Someone outbid them, whatever. But it's like, yeah, you could do that with an LLC, but you wouldn't. And like, okay, and now all those people can be congregated together, working together, deciding what they want to do with it next, casting other votes. And like, it's a simple example, but it's the same thing where there's that building block of ownership being fluid and free and programmable and easy, that through tokens, the same, this is Chris Dixon's analogy. I don't want to steal it, but like the website is the building block for information exchange. The token is the building block for ownership exchange. And that if we see tokens as just this new way to build new ideas upon, it's very likely that when we look back in 25 years, we'll be miles away right now from even thinking about what things that enables, but there's that same feeling of like, this can do things that are special.
Mm-hmm. We're going to give some more concrete examples in a second. One thing that I've heard from some of the smartest people on the planet is that this time is like going from having no internet to having the internet. It was such an explosion of technologies, and we're about to see another leap that size or greater. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I do believe that. I think, I don't know if technologies is the right word. I think the changes that Web3 will bring in are a lot more human and a lot more about how we structure relationships with each other and coordinate with each other. And so it's very possible that the coolest things that come from this feel very non-technical in the end. Wow. It's just the tech underlying it.
Got it. So about 6 weeks ago, actually a little more context. I live in Austin, Texas. I'm surrounded by people that are obsessed with Web3 and building things, also investing. And yet I've had this mixture of not a ton of interest, but also like feeling just very overwhelmed with how to even get started. I have no coding background, and it just seemed so overwhelming to me to even get my foot in the door. And then you sent out one of your monthly newsletters, What I'm Learning, about how to learn Ethereum in a day and to do a little bit of all of the kind of most popular things that one could do in the Ethereum world. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, so like there's a whole world of this, and like where most of my time is spent is on the like actual Solidity development, writing code for that world. But the point of code, same as the internet, lots of people write code, then you as a user just type something in the URL bar. But we're so used to that, right? Like maybe maybe in the early days of the internet, it's like, wait, there's this bar and I write a word in it, mm-hmm. and then it takes me to a website. Like, where's the website coming from? Like, there's all these new intuitions you need to build about how things should work. And I remember being in the space of like, cool, I got some Ether in my Coinbase account. That's like an investment, but like there's a whole world where I can use it. What does that even mean? How does it get there? Like, it just felt there's this barrier that I don't think needs to be there. And so honestly, for me, it came from both trying to convince my dad to play around with this a bit more. And I had an interaction with someone on Twitter who's a big investor in the space who's saying, I don't know how to use any of it. And I was like, just go play with it. And he's like, I don't even know what that means. So I'm like, okay, between those two things, I should just give the advice I would give to him, send it over and share that publicly. So it was just a walkthrough of, if you have a day, how do you actually get money into this ecosystem? What can you do with it? Walking through the process, getting through to the scariness, because we've talked about like pushing the button to buy something can be really scary when it's just this new world and they're signing transactions and it feels a little spooky. But just getting that muscle memory of like how this works and understanding it. And it got a really big response. I wrote it. I almost didn't send it because I'm like, this is so specific. I just wrote this for these two people. Like, mm-hmm. this is, no one's going to care.
That's
about
like
this.
Quintessential how you're supposed to
I
write.
I know, yeah. And I've given that advice so many times. But I felt like, I don't know, I tend to want my newsletter to be more like something I'm thinking about that's more interesting. Yeah. And this was like very practical guide that I'm like, 90% of people will not want to go through this guide. But it got a really, really good response and had a lot of people reach out that like they've done it, takes a day, and like now they've got the comfort of like, cool, I know how all this works and I can start to do the kind of loose, wild exploration more on my own.
So, you know, I shared with you earlier, Dee and I spent 4 or 5 hours doing the entire thing together, partly because I felt like I was learning a little bit more and I'm surrounded by all of my friends are very into this, and I was trying to get her more into it so we can invest more, but it wasn't having the same effect because she didn't feel like she understood any of it. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't understand any of it either, but I'm just like a bigger risk taker. So we did it together. We had so much fun and we did all of the things. It felt like I was an old person trying to use an iPhone for the first time.
No but intuition. It's so, because you're used to like with an iPhone or anything, it's like, even you see it with babies, they play around with an iPhone and they're like, they get how to swipe and whatever, but at the beginning you're like, wait, I move my finger to the right to make it go left. Like they're trying to emulate real world things. And like, there's just things you gotta, okay, if I delete it, is it really going away? Or is it just all the things that are baked into what you assume about a computer, and you got to relearn all of them. Cause you're like, oh, well, I send a transaction. Where is it? Is it going to happen? How do I know if I can just cancel it? Like there's like a new set of intuitions to build. Mm-hmm. And part of that is like, there's a huge UX problem. Like, I think everyone in the space knows the next wave of onboarding is going to come from making the experience a lot better. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, there's just going to be new intuition stuff to build mm-hmm. that I think like takes a little playing around with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mindset around it is, even if we're not going to invest a bunch of money in it, it feels like this is the way that the internet is going. There's going to be opportunity. There's going to be new ways of communicating with each other and navigating the internet. And we all just get to go through the discomfort of learning something new right now.
Right. That's how it starts, man. Just wait. The rabbit hole's waiting.
Yes.
Which actually, rabbit hole will bring me to the other thing that I've played with a bit, but hadn't used that was like my backup recommendation that is also very cool. Like if you're not doing that article I laid out, there's a thing called Rabbit Hole, I think .gg. And it's a site where they same things like little tutorials on a whole bunch of different areas, but a really smart model where they've got those different protocols to pitch in a little bit of money so that if people go through the tutorial, you earn a little bit of their token. Because they're trying to say like teach new users how to use this.
Yeah.
And so as you learn all these different areas, you can also earn a little bit of all these tokens and kind of play with it that way. So I think there's for people who are like wanting to get into it, that's another really fun place to start.
That's great. So what is your Substack so that if people want to go and read this and try this thing, they can do it?
Yeah, it's Obront, O-B-R-O-N-T .substack.com.
.substack.com. Awesome, brother.
Sweet. Dude,
this is so fun, man. Yeah. It's taken way too long to do this.
I know. We had to wait for all these ideas to percolate. Now that's we're right. finally that's ready. Right. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, man. Anything else you want to leave people with? Anything else they should know about?
No, that's it.
Awesome.
All right. Take care.
Later, man.